are listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Mary Harris. Nick Nolte became a household name playing Tom in the ABC miniseries Rich Man, Poor Man in 1976. And now his Hollywood career has spanned more than four decades. Okay, among the movies he's appeared in, 48 Hours, Cape Fear, Affliction, The Prince of Tides, Tropic Thunder, and Warrior. His new memoir, Rebel, My Life Outside the Lines, reveals a man behind those roles, a high school athlete, a regional actor, drug addict, father. Rebel is by turns funny and also heartbreaking. It is published by William Morrow. I'm so happy it brings Nick Nolte to the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You know, the first thing you notice when you open this book are the drawings at the front. Are those yours?
Yeah, those are mine when I wasn't sure what I was doing. So I just draw abstractions. I think I might have been studying photography at the time.
Why do you want to include them?
I think they psychologically tell something about a young man's unformed abstraction of an idea.
So this is young Nick that we're seeing in the front with these drawings.
Yeah, it would be young Nick.
You say you got into acting because real life was hard for you.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, childhood was paradise. That was beautiful.
That's how we all feel, yeah?
Yeah, and it was small town Iowa, Ames, Iowa. 5 minutes on your bike any direction you were in the country. I just got to be in nature and everything. Then we moved and eventually ended up in Omaha, Nebraska. And that's when it became difficult. When I had to start to deal with groups, and I found myself about every 3 years being ostracized by my friends, and I couldn't figure out why this was happening. So my father would notice it, so he would have to drive me to the theater on the weekend, but finally, it came to a crux because the kid that took my position beat everybody up in the cloak closet.
Huh.
So Dean Miller raised his hand in social studies class, and he said, well, why don't we do to Joe what we did to Nick? And then my ears just went boom, because right then and there they discussed that Nick's energy was such that he would overtake everybody else's energy and playing games and become a dictator.
So it was a way of asserting dominance.
Yeah. Huh. It was just natural energy I had. So then I had to start to learn to lose.
Huh.
For instance, I could do the broad jump maybe a foot past Jim Sell and Steve Limbert. And I always knew that they marked me 6 inches back. And I used to object about it, but now I didn't object. I let them mark me inches back, and then even sometimes they would win. And I allowed that to happen, and it didn't happen as much, you know. But it was because I was, just boundless energy that, you know. I towed a tee off, a driver, and it went at a right angle, hit a kid in the head. We were 5 years old. It made such a loud noise. I ran into the woods and wouldn't come out. I thought I'd killed him. I just was sure.
What did acting let you do that real life didn't?
Huh?
What did acting let you do that real life didn't?
Well, it allowed me to play in these playing fields. You know, it's a carryover from childhood. It's play. And it's a fertile imagination. And so acting fit right into that. I didn't know that, you know, because I took the adult course of trying to do something serious. I wanted to be an athlete.
You know? Football, right?
Yeah, football.
Why football?
Well, because I was kind of suited for it best. I was 6'1", and by the time I could catch up to my own skinny weight, I could get up to 220, and, you know, but I was fitted real good for junior college ball, you know. And so my plan was to go. I had a family member that went to 8 different universities.
8?
Yeah, and he got caught at USC. He finally got good, you know, so they caught him. So I thought I could do that with junior college ball. You just transfer your high school transcript.
Just keep going.
And just keep going.
And just keep going.
Yeah, I never went to a class, you know, so they were going to catch me. There was no question about it.
So when did you decide you wanted to become an actor?
When all that world crashed.
Hmm.
And it was because Pasadena was very insular, but Jim Nelson, football, fullback, he told me about the Iron Worker Union opening up some jobs and that we should go down, get in the union. It's $15 an hour, $20 an hour. And so we did. We joined the Iron Workers Union. We spent the summer building the storm drains for L.A. You know, L.A. is really a swampland. It's only a few places are high. Hollywood's a little high, but normally it would be covered with water. So underneath L.A. are caverns about 40 by 40, and these all run to the ocean. Coldwater Canyon, Benedict Canyon, Laurel Canyon, those are all rivers. There's only one river left open, that's the L.A. River. So we were building these underground.
So how did you go from that to acting?
Well, you leave town. That's what you got to do first.
You were discovered, right?
Well, several times. But, you know, that never worked out. You know, the discovery was not about my acting ability.
What was it about?
Yeah, it had something to do with harassment. But, you know, so what happened was that I found myself in more erratic behavior, you know, drinking too much. Barney would have to pick me out of the street. I lived with two gals up in Laurel Canyon. I was younger brother. They were in their 30s. I was in just 21.
And these were very liberated women. They had very kind of open house.
Yeah. One was married to a bass player in a Shelly Mann's band, and but divorce. So there were a lot of musicians coming and going. Lawrence Tierney lived there for a while, and I'd listen to Larry talk about acting and all that. And then I started studying with a guy up Laurel Canyon who was named Brian O'Byrne. And Tom Connolly at the time was trying for the role of a younger brother in Peyton Place. And he said, why don't you come to one of my rehearsals one of my classes with Brian O'Byrne? And Brian said, well, you can't be here without reading. So he forced me to read.
What did you get from it?
He came afterwards, and when Tom wasn't listening, he said, you don't know it, but you're an actor. And I said, oh, I don't want to, and, you know, I was shy, you know, very shy kid. And so I used to run into cars head first, parked cars. So I thought that was a little odd.
Yeah.
You know, I think
so you knew you had this energy.
Yeah.
And acting, it seems like, gave you a way to focus it.
Yeah, but I wasn't solidly committed to acting yet. I was still an iron worker, and we were going to use that to live off of unemployment the rest of the year and mess around in Hollywood.
And plan.
Yeah, and I was running with a pretty rough crowd, John Altoon, the painter, and Lawrence Harvey, you know. So I had what I think a lot of people have. You have breakdowns, but not full breakdowns. They're kind of reorganizations of your home.
I love that way of saying it, reorganization.
Yeah, and that's the way it really was. It took about a year because there were a lot of skills that I hadn't developed. Reading, for instance. And I had to go back and pick all those up. I had a lot of issues of why did I stick so heavily with athletics. Hmm. Part of it was the rejection I had gotten. You know, I'd been voted off of teams. I was kicked out of Bud Wilkinson's football camp for a prank that Oklahoma guys don't quite take to. You know, so you'll have to read the book to find out. I don't know if it's in the book or not.
You're listening to Midday on WNYC, and you're listening to Nick Nolte, who is talking about Rebel, My Life Outside the Lines, his new memoir. You know, one of the things I loved about this memoir was you talking about how you get into character for your roles. Like right now, you're sitting here with a giant beard, big hair, and you're like, this is for a role. But you also talk about all sorts of other stuff you've done. Like, for instance, for Down and Out in Beverly Hills, like how did you get into character to play a homeless person?
Yeah. Well, that was Paul Mazursky. And Paul came out to look at me. And I knew he wanted Jack Nicholson, but Jack didn't want to do it. So Paul looked at me, and he's kind of a sardonic guy. He turned around and said, oh, I've seen, and started to walk away. I said, no, wait, Paul, don't you want to read? He said, read what? I said, this script? And he said, you want to read this script? I said, yeah. So for the next 3 hours, we sat there and read Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
What'd you think?
Well, it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny at all. Because, two people read it back and forth, you can't deliver it.
Yeah.
Right. So at the end, he was kind of exhausted, frustrated, and mad. And so he said, okay, I'm leaving. And I said, well, we've got to talk a little bit about it. He said, you've got the role.
He's like, just relax.
So I just wore him out, and he gave me the role, which I guess he was going to anyway.
But you lived life as a homeless person in order to get into character.
Yeah, he took me down to the Mission. And then he said, I have an actor friend, and he's going to be with you, and you guys are going to live on the street. Well, it doesn't take more than one night on the street, and you're just wide. You're gapped out, you know.
What does that mean?
Well, it's the consciousness that we see of street people. They're muttering to themselves. They talk to themselves. They're in a lost world. That happens almost immediately.
Happened to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Huh. It happens to everybody. Because you don't have a purpose. You don't really have a home. You don't know where you're going to end up. And if you're new in town, you can't be going down this block or this block. There's one block, Al turned. He wanted to go down that block. But it was all burned out cars. I said, no. We can't go down that. He said, no, I'm going down it. So I went ahead and got about halfway, and a black cat standing watching me, and he came walking across the street smoking a joint, and he would hit it, and he walked right up to me and he handed me the joint. Well, he was trying to find out if I was a cop or not. So I smoked the joint, and then we were allowed to pass. But every car you didn't want to look into, because there were some sexual acts going on in those cars. That's what's going on.
Women are a big part of your story, too, in this book.
Yes.
And I found that really fascinating. Women pushing boundaries, starting with your mom. You said your mom worked. Was that, like, pretty rare for the time?
Oh, totally. Huh. Women couldn't really go to work before World War II without the sanction of a community. So, and I don't know many women that had the sanction of a community. So when the war happened, my mother went right to work. And she also worked at Marshall Field's after graduation and was dating Frank Capone, and my father quit his highway job and went to Chicago.
Went to go get her.
Yeah, went to get her. And he played pro football there in Chicago.
Well, you've been really open about your history with addiction, and you do tell this one story about your mom, how she used to wake you up for school some days with what she called a vitamin.
Yeah. Well, it was common in those days. All the soldiers came home with their Dexedrine because they had war battles to fight and stuff. And World War II was so horrific. Yes, there was a celebration, but the battlers did not want to go out. Mm. They would have parties in their house. So you'd have the McGuires and the Noltes. And Jack McGuire was the head swimming coach at Iowa State. He was a 6'5" redheaded Irishman. And my dad was 6'6". So you get those two big men together, and they would drink, and there'd be a bowl of pills out there.
Really?
Yeah. And then they would party, and then the weekend would be over. So my mother continued that on the rest of her life. And when I got really rebellious and wouldn't get up to go to school, she would say, "Well, are you going to school?" I said, "I don't know. If I wake up, I will." She said, "Here, take your vitamin pill." And she'd give me a 4-hour Dexedrine heart.
How do you look at that now? Because you're a parent now. And,
yeah.
But you also have a very, the way you talk about drugs and addiction is also, it's like very open. It's very different, I find, than how most people talk about it.
You have to be open about it. You have to be, you can't make drugs anything more special than life. They're just part of it. And addiction is part of our nature. It's part of survival. But when you get it in the situations that we are getting it, in forms of acts of rebellion or to get away from reality, then it becomes a problem. Then these things become issues. So I would never give my kid like my mother did, but what my mother thought was just, they didn't call it an amphetamine or anything. They called it a pick-me-up pill.
Mm.
You know, so it was a different mentality about it. Of course, I caught on to what they were and gave them to all the football players, and we had a good season. But, you know, so today what we have now is really addiction problems.
Yeah.
And that's because now we know what these pills can do. And what they do is like the pain pills, they change your mood. They make you feel better a little bit. And then if you stay with that, you don't create any more endorphins. And so then you can't take care of your own pain. And then to make the switch is really hard to do.
Yeah.
And you have to do it. You have to make the switch if you're going to get off.
And you tell this really touching story about your son, about how when he was young, doctors wanted to put him on ADHD meds, and you said no.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my son, he went through a tough divorce, and the mother wanted to live in Florida. And I was doing a film in Pittsburgh, so in the middle of this, I get a phone call from her and say, "Well, our son is ADD'd, and he's not reading in school, and he won't do this and won't do that." And I said, "Rebecca, just promise me you will not put him on Ritalin. I'll get there as soon as this film is over." So I called my mom and I said, "Do you have any Ritalin?" And she said, "Yeah, I do." I said,
she just had it?
Yeah, because they had shifted her off. You know, amphetamines have become a bad thing.
Right.
So now Ritalin, they didn't know quite how it worked, but it worked similarly. So I said, "Look, I need 8 pills because there was the principal, the psychiatrist, Rebecca, and about 4 teachers. So it was about 7, including me, would be 8. So So we had this big meeting as soon as I got there. And they went around to a T, say, yeah, he is ADD'd. Yeah, he's talking about burning the school. He says that they don't know what kind of power he has and all of that, and he won't read. And I said, well, have any of you thought that maybe he's gone through a horrific divorce and he's just really damaged right now? Mm. No. This is far beyond that, far beyond that. You think so? Okay. Well, before we put him on Ritalin, I suggest, and plunk, I put the 8 pills out on the table, we should each try one to see what the effect is on the child.
I love that.
And they all went, oh, no, not me. I'm normal. I can't. I said, there's no such thing as normal. You know that. You should find out what it's a very diluted combination of things. You'll be off it in an hour or so. No, we can't take that one. Okay. All right, well, give me 2 weeks with this boy, and I'll get to the bottom of it, you know. But don't expect him to change right away.
Yeah.
So for the next 2 weeks, I would take Brawley to school. We'd listen to the Howard Stern show. That was his favorite show. And then one day Howard said, well, who do you think should play this role, Nick Nolte or Gary Busey? And Brawley looked at me like, what? And he said, yeah, I know him. And he clicked off Howard. He didn't want to listen to it anymore. But finally what happened is I got him close to the shrink's office. And then I had to drag him in there. And then he sat in a chair and would not speak. And I said to the psychiatrist, is this what happens? And he said, yeah. And I grabbed him out of the chair, put him on the floor, and started tickling him. He started hitting me with his fists, and tears started to flood. He'd just say, Dad, I don't want to be here. And he got it all out.
Hmm.
And the psychiatrist says, well, he doesn't have ADD. I said, no, he doesn't.
Yeah, you have this beautiful line in the book where you say, our fathers should teach us how to love as men, and yet they do not.
That's been the big thing.
Yeah,
that goes clear back to affliction. What is affliction? It's an inherited, almost biblical piece that is a blank spot in male learning.
Yeah.
Mother naturally nourishes. A father has to find a way
to do that.
To love the boy and to teach him how to love.
Do you feel like you did that?
Have I done that? I've tried. Men are not perfect at loving, you know. They can feel it. They're not the culture's not geared around the subtleties of it, you know.
Yeah.
The attention it takes.
Yeah, you have your own Harvey Weinstein story in here, too.
Yeah. Harvey, of course, I never saw him do anything to me, you know, of groping or anything. But Harvey was a destructive force within the film element. He made many great films, but that was always at the cost of other films. He would buy up films that would compete against his films or compete against what he wanted to win, and he could control sometimes the electoral process of best film, you know. William Defoe said to me one time, I said, well, this Death Wish is going to come out. I got a call from Harvey about the press conference. And he said, well, it hasn't happened yet. I have 5 films that have been on the shelf for any number of years, 6 years and stuff, and he has never released them.
I'm Mary Harris. I have been speaking with Nick Nolte, whose new book is Rebel, My Life Outside the Lines. Tonight at 7:15, he'll be appearing at the 92nd Street Y. Find out more information on our show page at WNYC/midday. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.